Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So pro basketball took Monday off to allow the NCAA to have the spotlight. Then the NBA. No. Check that. The National Basketball Association. Because it earned its full government last night. It came back with a vengeance. Here is a brief list of what went down last night. There was a send-off for Dirk in Dallas. It included him going for 30 and then announcing his retirement. Jamal Crawford becoming the oldest player to break 50 in a game. Anthony Davis breaking out a "That's all, folks" shirt for the season finale in New Orleans. Dwayne Wade going out in Miami. And I'll get to more of that in a second. But then all of that was erased. I mean, it was an amazing night, and then it was all erased in a single moment. Think about that. Two legends leave the stage on the same night. Jamal Crawford has an unreal performance. Anthony Davis goes full troll job with his clothing. And then all of that may as well have never even happened because of what happened in Staples last night. You know what I'm talking about. Alex Caruso going for 12 points, 13 assists, and 7 boards against the Blazers. Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
That was a where were you moment. Where were you when that happened? Let me open up the phones right now. I'll break the format. 1-800-636-8686. Where were you when the dude who has been glossed, Steve Blake's dad, was playing Russell Westbrook? I'll tell you where you were. I'll tell you where everyone who covers the Lakers was. Yeah, that's it. They were in the tunnels, under Staples, listening to this.
So today, I'm going to step down as president. And I think I don't want to, her and I have such an amazing relationship. And I think that she gave me full power to do what I wanted to do. But I think that with her and I want to always preserve our relationship and love her. And then I think that I had more fun when I was able to be the big brother and ambassador to everybody. You know, I thought about Dwayne Wade retiring tomorrow, and I can't even tweet it out or can't be there.
The hell was that? No, seriously. What the hell was that? I mean, I know what happened. Did Magic quit as Lakers president? But seriously, the hell was that? Because that was not somebody quitting a job. That was somebody spending nearly an hour making a complete and total embarrassment of himself and the once proud organization that he balled out for. There are a dozen different ways to quit. And that one was pretty much the worst one of all. The Brian Colangelo burner scandal. Cannot believe how that went down. You remember that scandal? Remember when that was like the weirdest thing ever? Well, Irv just went secretariat on that. And Magic Johnson, Lakers president, just went Usain Bolt on Magic Johnson, talk show host, and Magic Johnson, head coach, in the race for worst job performance ever. Has there ever been an executive of a pro sports franchise that handled anything worse than Irv handling quitting on the Lakers? Hell, has anybody anywhere in any walk of life ever handled anything as badly as Irv handled that resignation? I mean, I don't have time for the entire bizarre, weird, embarrassing, awkward hour that Irv spent puking all over himself. But here are a few highlights. Quote, "Somebody is going to have to tell my boss because I know she's going to be sick. But I knew I couldn't face her face to face and tell her, even though I was just with her yesterday and we had a 3-hour meeting about the direction of this great organization. So today, Rachel, I free my love." End of quote. I mean, what a crap load of garbage that is in just 3 sentences. This guy quit, and he's doing it by telling the media before telling Jeannie Buss. He didn't have the guts to tell her to her face, so he's doing it this way. My man, people who ghost other people cannot believe how cowardly and lame that is. But more on that relationship with Jeannie Buss in a second. Because let's not sleep on the fact that he was saying what a great three-hour meeting he had with Jeannie Buss on Monday. And then he quit on Tuesday. And then he capped it off by telling Rachel Nichols that, quote, "I'm free, my love."
I'm free, my love.
All right. Okay. But there's more. Believe that. There's a lot more. There's this.
You know, I love her as a sister. And so today, I'm going to step down as president. Her and I have such an amazing relationship. She gave me full power to do what I wanted to do. But I think that with her and I want to always preserve our relationship.
Yeah, because nothing says love and respect in an amazing relationship like quitting without telling her. Yeah, that's your sister. She's fam. She fully trusted you. She empowered you to do whatever you wanted to do in that capacity. Handed you the freaking keys to the entire kingdom. And man, you didn't even have the decency or the courage or the professionalism to tell her to her face. And you say that you're doing that to preserve, quote, the amazing relationship. Man, what planet is this dude living on? Could dude be any more out of touch than he is? Any more whack than he's acting? He didn't tell Jeannie Buss. All right, fair enough. Weird, but fair enough. He must have told LeBron, right? Nope. According to reports, he met with LeBron and Rich Paul on Saturday. None of that came up. According to media reports, LeBron James had to hear about Magic Johnson quitting from media reports. It's amazing. So exactly why is this guy quitting? Why is this guy quitting? Here comes the real, and it is beautiful.
I think that I had more fun when I was able to be the big brother and ambassador to everybody. You know, I thought about Dwayne Wade retiring tomorrow, and I can't even tweet it out or can't be there.
Wait. What? I'm sorry. Come again? I thought about Dwayne Wade retiring tomorrow, and I can't even tweet it out or be there. Did he really just say that he quit being president of the Lakers so he could tweet about Dwayne Wade retiring? There's no way that he said that. There's no way that's true. That had to be a misspeak. Let me check something else now.
And now with the the fines and the tampering and this and that, I can't help young men who want me to help them, or I can't tweet out, like Russell Westbrook, that was a great feat the other day, and I couldn't even tweet it out to say, hey, congratulations, man.
So I have this straight. He quit being president of the LA Lakers so he could tweet congratulations to Russell Westbrook. The hell is that? Now I'm beginning to understand Antonio Brown a lot better. You want to know just how addictive Twitter is? Magic Johnson quit his job for Twitter. There's your headline. Forget the Lakers and where they go. The headline is Magic Johnson quits on his beloved organization, his sister, and everything in his work life that he loves for Twitter. And here's another note. And you're not going to want to hear this, Irv. No one gives a damn about your tweets. Not Dwanye, not Russ, not anyone. Magic sucks at Twitter. He's even worse at Twitter than he is at being president of the Lakers. And he was a horrible team president. Horrible. Everybody knows that. I mean, I can run down a series of hideous moves that happened on his watch. Traded D'Angelo Russell. Didn't re-sign Julius Randle. Couldn't even get a meeting with Paul George. Couldn't trade for Anthony Davis. I mean, to the extent that anything in sports is a disaster, that was a disaster. A complete and utter disaster. A dumpster fire. A train wreck. A nuclear meltdown. It was all that and more. And if you're wondering why it didn't work with Magic, you got a sense of it last night. Because my man did not want to be team president. He wants to be Twitter president. He simply was not cut out for being a team president. A shorter version of Magic's presser last night would have been, this team president game is hard, dog.
Dog, man, I almost choked on my spit. That rapping game is hard, dog.
And he's right. It is. It's really hard. It requires a ton of work, a ton of scouting, grinding, evaluating talent, making hard decisions, and having hard conversations. And if last night has shown us anything at all, Magic does not want the hard conversation. Magic did not want the hard work. He didn't want any of it. And on so many levels, On so many levels, this guy's making no sense. Like, so you wanted to hype Russell Westbrook, somebody who plays for a rival, but you didn't want to talk to your sister, Jeannie Buss, about why you're leaving. Like, you want to mentor Ben Simmons, but you don't want to mold an entire roster with the team that's paying you that you love. You want to congratulate D'Angelo Russell for making the All-Star team, but you don't want to talk to Luke Walton about his future. Hey, clones, check it out. If I had to sum up what this show is all about, I would say it comes down to one word: performance. Same thing for you, right? Whether it's an important meeting, business trip, or you're fighting that afternoon crash, sometimes you need a boost, but you want something different than coffee or that sugary energy drink. I discovered something that will help you take your game to the very next level. It's called Dawn to Dusk. It's by Brickhouse Nutrition. Dawn to Dusk was designed to be a healthier, more effective alternative to typical energy supplements. With as little caffeine as a single cup of coffee, Dawn to Dusk provides up to 10 hours of clean energy. It heightens focus. It improves your mood. And unlike coffee or energy drinks, there are no jitters or a crash, just clean energy and focus and no calories or sugar. Go to BrickHouseRome.com. BrickHouseRome.com. Get 15% off your first order with the offer code ROME. 100% satisfaction guaranteed. You've got nothing to lose, everything to gain. BrickHouseRome.com. Once again, BrickHouseRome.com. Tony Bennett is my guest. Tony, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well and maybe even better than well right now.
I would imagine. In fact, why don't you tell me first what the last few days have been like since you beat Texas Tech 85-77 in overtime on Monday night?
It's been exciting, Jim. It's just, you know, it starts to sink in more and more. I don't know if it's fully done it, but to see the celebration of your kids and your staff and then the fans back home is really gratifying, and just you're kind of overwhelmed with thankfulness as it happens. And the game itself was such a good one to win it. Our last three have been as improbable as it gets, but that last one was a high level game in the championship, and I'm glad that it went like that.
Those last three truly were amazing. Tony Bennett joining us. I would imagine, Tony, something like that, with the magnitude of something like that, it's going to take some time to sink in. But I think back to John Calipari, and he told me, Tony, that when he won in 2012, that he was not a better coach the Tuesday morning after the win than he had been the Monday before it. Do you feel any different now that you've got that national title on your resume?
No, not really. I think Dean Smith had a statement like 3 hours after he won it saying, I'm no better of a coach now. And I think coaches, as I've said before, get too much credit when it goes well and maybe too much blame when it doesn't go well. But that's why the regular season championship in a conference, I think that's the test of, you know, over 18 games, 2-3 months on the road, is the true test of who's the best. To win a national championship, you have to be healthy, matchups matter, you have to have good fortune, and it's a little different kind of test.
Virginia head basketball coach Tony Bennett joins us. You know, in watching that game, which was an absolute battle between two amazingly tough teams, one of the things that stood out to me once again, Tony, was how calm you were. It's not unusual, but these were really intense moments in the brightest spotlight. You seem so mellow. Is that how you were really feeling, or were you just doing a really good job of hiding it?
I think you have to be true to your personality, and of course you're intense. But I'm so into the moment. My dad told me before, he said, just stay in the lines. Once you step in between the lines, stay in the lines. And so you're just thinking, all right, how do we adjust? What do we do? What can I share with my guys? And as far as, you know, being intense, that's sometimes in the huddles, in the locker room. But that's consistent to how our staff has tried to be all year with our guys and reading how they respond best.
You know, Tony, you mentioned your dad. There was a lot made about your dad, the legendary Dick Bennett, being at the game on Monday night. What did it mean to you to have him there and to share that with him?
Well, it was the best. You know, first you share it with your team, your wife and kids, but the impact my dad's had on my basketball career is significant. And to coach in that game, you know, I think of playing for him and coaching under him, he prepared me to be in that moment. Our style is sometimes, you know, criticized, which is no problem, but it's a style that prepares you to play against the best in the toughest of settings, because it's all about soundness on both ends and toughness. And I think that will, in that setting, give you a chance. And that's why his fingerprints were all over that. And I think he prepared me to be in that moment.
Virginia Cavaliers are the national champs. Their head coach, Tony Bennett, joins us. And Tony, you've said that Dabo Swinney sent you a text And that text read, "Let the light that shines in you be brighter than the light that shines on you." What does that message mean to you?
Isn't that great? Yeah, I was thinking about that as you asked that question before. But I just think it means all the preparation, all the things that matter to you and your program and your young men, that's what it's about. Because if you take in too much of the periphery or all the magnitude of it, I think you can get lost or seduced by everything. But if you can stay into what matters and in that moment, that's what's going to be important. And again, for me, it takes on the meaning of, all right, my faith and my perspective and my peace, which also helps me keep my calm, maybe more than anything on the sidelines.
You know, so I think that explains to a certain extent, or maybe even a large extent, your peace, your tranquility, your calm. But then look at the players. You mentioned the final three games. I mean, your guys were in moments of excruciating pressure, and they came through time and time again against Purdue, DeAndre Hunter against Texas Tech, Kyle Guy's free throws against Auburn. I mean, I'm sure that they can take, at least in part, some of that ability to stay calm as a reflection from you, but I'm guessing you're not going to take credit for that. How do you explain their calmness under pressure?
I think that's it's an easy answer. This team all year has had to face a unique pressure that's probably different. Well, it is different than any team in the history of college basketball's faced by what happened in terms of our loss in the NCAA tournament. It was there all year. We stepped into it. We said we'd own it. But a step further, what happened in the NCAA tournament was this year we're down 14 to Gardner-Webb, another 116, and you could feel all those emotions and feelings coming back. And I think because our guys experienced that and they didn't panic and they fought to get through it, that allowed them to handle the pressures of the games following after. So that was my pregame talk to them before the game. I said, you were down 14, you faced that kind of pressure. That's prepared you for this moment when you face the stresses and pressure of the game. So that was I'm not going to say it was an unfair advantage, but it was a unique advantage that only they could have because of how it played out last year.
You know, I would imagine, Tony, it's one thing to think that, but it's another thing to put that into practice. Like, for instance, you said if you use it the right way, the adversity will buy you a ticket to a place that you could not have gone any other way, end quote. I guess in theory, I fully accept that. But how do you learn practically to use that adversity the right way?
It was all intentional from the moment that happened. My wife went to a TED Talk about 5 or 6 years ago, and that was one of the quotes. It's called The Storyteller. And she said, you might want to show this to your team, because she had showed it to my kids, our kids, and other people. She said, this might be helpful in starting your year. So I watched it, showed it to the team. We used that quote and reminded of them often. We put them in spots. We made them own, and all of us own what it was and how it would help us grow. And it drew us together in ways that only that could. And I think it allowed us to get to that moment. Whether it was a national championship or not, it certainly did some things that adversity helped us get to, and we wouldn't have any other way.
Tony Bennett, my guest. I guess then as a follow-up, to put this bluntly, are you winning a national title this season if you don't suffer that loss last season?
That's a great question. I mean, if we had gone to the Sweet 16 last year or won a game in it, could we have? Perhaps. But I think this helped our chances greatly by experiencing that. And it can do one way or the other. It can crumble you, or it can take you and make you better to where you want to go on. And so I probably go towards that experience probably helped us get there more than anything else.
Tony Bennett joining us. You know, I would imagine you learned so much from the experience and the players learned so much from that experience. But how much did you learn about and from your players over the course of the last 12 months?
A ton, because the resiliency, the poise, and the ability to make, you know, this is what I've told. I made peace with whatever the outcome would be this year. If we were good enough to get to another NCAA tournament, well, they were good enough to win a conference championship and then get another number one seed, which, you know, is a little like, do we want that? Because we know what comes with that. So I think that all that stuff being there was significant.
You know, Tony, I've talked to so many coaches that finally break through and they win the thing. And I think maybe this is changing a little bit. I hope it's changing a little bit, because back in the day, it always seemed like there wasn't any joy in the victory, only relief in being able to check that box and then not having to deal with that anymore. How did it feel to you? Was there joy and exhilaration, or was there more a sense of relief in winning?
it's all of the above. But as I was saying before, you know, I made peace, as I said, if we lost another first-round game, didn't get to a championship or a Final Four, I knew I'd be okay. And I thought that freed me up to enjoy it more and go after it harder so that when it did happen, I think I did experience an exhilaration. And because I shared it with those guys who had gone through adversity, my family, my dad, all those things, it just enhanced it. So I fully enjoyed it. I'm enjoying it now, but it's not going to change who I am or who these young men are.
Tony Bennett, my guest. All right, finally, then, one more detail about your dad. As you told Jim Nantz, the deal was your dad said if you ever got to the Final Four, he'd play golf with you at Augusta National. Has a tee time been set yet?
It hasn't, but I'm not going to let him turn that one down because I had a chance for him before, and I said, Dad, we can go play Augusta. And he said, well, he said, I tell you what, you get to a Final Four, and then I'll do it with you. So that's happened, so he's got to come up on his end if I came up on my end. Don't you agree?
Oh, I agree, Tony. I agree. You definitely have to hold him to that. I know he'll make good on that. What's it like to get out there with Pops and play golf?
Whether it's fishing, hunting, or just doing whatever, when you have those moments as a father and a son, the golf course is, he loves golf and I love it too. And I don't play much, but those are sacred times. And, you know, he's 75 now and I'm getting close to 50. I cherish those moments and I can't wait for that one.
The Stanley Cup playoffs start tonight. You got to be kidding me.
Acknowledge one quick thing. The haters, because some of you think this is some kind of bit. Some of you think this is some sort of elaborate setup, some audio magic perhaps, where Alvin spends hours and hours pulling off. And not just the so-called Radio Shack employees, but actual callers. You know, like Kathleen from Omaha.
Enough. You're wrong. You pick Nashville. Or as I like to call them, Trashville. You did not pick Winnipeg. I heard, and it's the same as last year, when I know you picked Washington and Chicago. And the time before that, when it was L.A. and San Jose, you picked L.A. and you have really, really
Hey, Kathleen.
Hey, haters. Hear me clearly. I am making my pick. I am going out on a ledge. I am the man in the freaking arena. And I'm saying this loud, and I'm saying it clearly. There is a storm coming. The Lightning are winning the cup. Yeah, I said it. Yes, you heard it. The Tampa Bay Lightning are winning the Stanley Cup. John Cooper is the coach to get it done. John Cooper has already been knocking at the door. He's made it to the conference finals in 3 of the last 4 years. But this is the year that he and they finally hoist the cup. Nikita Kucherov is a freaking star. Steven Stamkos is a leader of men. Andrei Vasilevsky is a brick wall between the pipes. 2018 Norris Trophy winner Victor Hedman is back. He's healthy. Ryan McDonagh is ready to go. I know the past and I know the future. The future is the Lightning bringing the Stanley Cup back to Tampa. Now, don't at me for picking the team with the most wins, because going chalk in hockey is the most non-chalk thing ever. Winning the President's Trophy, hear me out. Winning the President's Trophy means pretty much nothing when it comes to winning Lord Stanley. If having the most regular season points meant that you would be the last team standing, then more than 8 of the last 32 President's Trophy winners would have done it. The team with the most regular season points has not won the cup since Chicago did it back in 2013. Something else I called, because I've never been wrong. Now, there are other teams to like. There are other teams that I really do like. Vegas is incredible. They nearly won it all last year in their first year of existence. And they look like the team to beat out west. especially with a three-time cup winner in Marc-Andre Fleury in between the pipes. Boston is playing really well right now. The face licker, Brad Marchand, could be back singing Black and Yellow, Black and Yellow again.
Black and Yellow, Black and Yellow. Yeah. What up, Boston? Thank you.
I mean, in a way, if I could see that again, I wouldn't even mind being wrong. Except I just don't see anybody beating Tampa Bay. Not even John Tortorella. Torts is the guy who led Tampa to their only other cup win. Torts is the guy who they face in round one. Don't get it twisted. Columbus may be an eight, but they've got way more talent than an eight. And they have Torts. They've got way more talent than an eight. Assuming everybody is able to take the ice and not, you know, anybody doing this.
He shit his pants, he was puking, he was doing everything.
He bleeped his pants, he was puking, he was doing everything.
He shit his pants, he was puking, he was doing everything.
So there is your Stanley Cup pick. There is your Stanley Cup champion. Take it to the freaking bank. Hate all you want, or take that information, run with it, get paid. A storm is coming. The Lightning are going to win the Stanley Cup. And if you want more in-depth analysis than what I just gave you, wait for my man Scotty Farrell.
The Stanley Cup playoffs start tonight. You got to be kidding me, Farrell.
That's exactly what I thought when I woke up this morning. Like, damn, you got to be kidding me. They do start. Time for me to help people get paid. Let's get a phone call in here. The aforementioned. It's like the bat signal went out. The Kathleen signal went out. Kathleen was the one. I played the soundbite. She was so upset saying, what are you doing, man? You're not telling the truth. You're not being honest. You're not being real. I heard you. Kathleen, I don't know what you heard, but I know what I said. Anyway, you have my pick. So I'll tell you what, Kathleen. Kathleen, you're on. So instead of you saying what I did or didn't do, why don't you give me your pick, Kathleen?
Penguins all the way. They got us. And take back what was taken from them last year, which should have been a three-peat if old Domo Washington hadn't got in their way. Penguins all the way.
All right, so Kathleen, let me ask you this. What do you
Four-time Stanley Cup winners for Sydney and the rest of them.
What do you like best about Sydney? What does he have to bring to this?
I don't know hockey that well, but I just know Penguins all the way.
Yeah, but you know Sydney. You know Sydney pretty well. What do you like best about Sydney?
I'm talking about Sydney and the stuff I said about him in the past. Forget about that. Just that they got to do what they failed to do last year, which really made me mad.
You know what, Kathleen? I respect that you don't want to live in the past and you're looking ahead, not back. But there are people listening right now.
Penguins, they infuriated me. They got to step it up. Take it back. Take the cup. Sydney, all of them, whatever. It ain't about Sydney's whatever. It's about them taking the cup back to where it belongs.
I got you. All right, Kathleen, thank you very much. She was too smart for that, wasn't she? She was not going there. She's like, I know what you're trying to do, Rome. I know what you're trying to get me to say. I'm not saying it. It's not about that. It's about the cup. All right. The thing about that is, Kathleen, I don't need you to say that because I've got that on tape. You know, you try and say that I said this, I said that, I had on tape. I have what you said on tape about Sydney, Kathleen.
How did he get that big, luscious ass and those succulent lips? Is your ass bigger than Madison Bumgarner of the San Francisco Giants? Oh, man.
No wonder she didn't want to go there. This show is like the internet. It's in ink. It's on tape. It's on DAT. This is why you can't accuse me of saying something I didn't say. It's all on tape. It's all on tape. We have it. Alvy rolled on that prediction. So when the Lightning finish this thing and they win their four series, I will be able to stand up in front of all of you and say, I hope you got down. Hope you made money. You're welcome. I have a very important message for you. Texting and driving isn't just a dangerous problem, it is deadly. If you drive while distracted, you are 3 times more likely to crash. But far too many people still do not recognize the dangers. Did you know that when you send or receive a text, you take your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds, and at 55 miles per hour, that's like driving more than the length of a football field with your eyes closed. Between 2012 and 2017, nearly 20,000 people died in crashes involving a distracted driver. If your own safety is not enough reason to stop driving while distracted, I'll give you another one. It's also illegal. This is why cops are writing tickets to anybody caught texting while driving, and they're doing it to save lives. Remember, if you text while driving, you will get caught. You drive, you text, you pay. Drew Tranquil. Drew, it's so good to have you on the show. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me.
My man, so much to talk to you about. I'm so glad to have you on finally. You know, we're about 15 days away from the start of the NFL draft. So what's the draft evaluation process, Drew, been like for you, and how have you gone about approaching it?
It's been great, really. I mean, you go, for me, it started out obviously with the Senior Bowl, and then coming back from that and getting healthy and getting ready to go for the combine. But right now, really, I mean, it's just private workouts, it's meetings, it's flying out, meeting with teams, and, you know, going to Chicago this Friday. And so really it's just tightening the hatches, and, you know, they're certainly tightening the hatches on their draft boards, and we'll get ready to go here in a couple weeks.
You know, and I'm going to talk about that in 1 minute, but as we go back, Drew, your road to this spot has been so fascinating to me. If you go back, for instance, to your time in high school, you were not just a good baseball player. You were an excellent baseball player. There was talk that you could play professionally. So what was it about football that drew you to it?
Man, it's just, I don't know, the passion for the game, the energy. It was just something, honestly, man, I felt in my heart. You know, going into my senior year of high school there, I was like, you know, would I rather play baseball and not play football, or play football and not play baseball? And for me, it was like, I couldn't let the game of football go. It meant too much to me and my family and to my community, and so that was kind of, I guess, what got the ball rolling there for recruiting purposes.
All right, Drew Tranquil joining us. So then you go to Notre Dame, and it's working out great. You're making an impact, but then you go down with that knee injury. What do you remember about that?
Well, it was tough for me. That was the first injury I'd really ever sustained in sports. I'd played baseball since I was 3 and tackle football since I was 5 or 6, and I'd never really sustained an injury and been held out of competition. And so it was all new to me. When I sustained the injury, I came to the sideline, and, you know, they messed with my knee a little bit and were like, you know, you've probably hyperextended it. And I went out and played the rest of the game. So to get the news that I had the ACL the next day was really shocking. And certainly a setback for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, Drew, that's really something. You laid that out, but just so everybody's clear on this, you suffer that injury, but you did pass the test for the ACL injury, and you keep playing in the game, and then you show up at the facility the next day, and your knee is blown up, and then you learn that it is a torn ACL. I mean, what in the world goes through your mind when you hear that news?
Well, I think devastation. I think as a competitor, you know, you want to be out there every week. You want to help your team win games, and for me, I was a freshman trying to earn and prove myself as a starter there at the safety position. And, you know, it was tough. I was like, dang, I'm set back now, you know, whatever it might be. But for me, it was how fast could I flip the switch and start setting goals for myself. And, you know, Adrian Peterson, I think, had just come back and from an ACL and really redefined the standard of coming back from knee injuries and had like a 2,000-yard rushing season. I was like, I wonder if I could do it faster than this guy. And it was really just about proving to myself coming back, but it was a devastating blow nonetheless.
Drew Tranquil getting ready for the NFL draft. Again, I want to be very clear about that. The story goes, and you pointed this out, but you wanted to see who on record had come back the fastest from an ACL injury because you wanted to see if you could beat that. And not only that, but you wanted to see if you could not only be squatting, but squatting more than anybody on the team. Like, Drew, most guys get down when they hear devastating news like that. How were you able to shift into attack mode as quickly as you did?
You know, I had a great support group around me. I have great parents. My wife's awesome. I got great teammates. But I want to say I heard the story of Marcus Luttrell, who was a Navy SEAL and, you know, has that movie and book, The Lone Survivor. But I heard a story from him of, you know, his like his whole platoon had just gotten knocked out, and he had been severely wounded, and he had to like a 7-mile crawl to like this village, and he was like, you know, the way I did it was I drew a line in the sand and I crawled past that point, and then I drew another line in the sand and I crawled past that point. For me, it was like, I'm just going to set these small goals and attack them every day, and then, you know, I'll probably look back 3 or 4 months from now, and that was where I was at. I was squatting, you know, more than anybody, and I was doing things I didn't think necessarily were possible, but that was kind of, I guess, my attack mentality was, you know, just be the best on these small goals, and you'll look back from now and have done things that you didn't necessarily think you could do.
So, Drew, just for the record, how quickly were you able to get back?
The first one, I got back on the field in 3.5 months. We didn't really engage me in any contact just for, you know, precautionary reasons, but I was back on the field, full pads, running around, breaking, getting in and out of breaks at 3.5, 4 months. So,
yeah, I mean, it's amazing, yeah. Drew, but as you just pointed out, you said the first one. I think a lot of people know where we're going with this, but in the event that they don't, then you're facing Georgia Tech. You're having a huge game, and you tear the ACL in your other leg. At that point, was there any part of you that was asking, why me? I've worked so hard, and now this, it's simply not fair.
You certainly have those feelings. I mean, you set goals for yourself, and for me, I wanted to come back as a sophomore and do these amazing things and redefine the standard, much like I said, you know, Adrian Peterson did. I wanted to be an All-American. I wanted to do these things, and to go down there after probably having one of the best halves of football I've ever played in my career was very, very difficult. And it definitely, the turnover time between having the injury and, like, flipping the switch to recovery was a couple days longer for that knee than it was for the first. I definitely felt like I sulked a little bit more, and I was just so frustrated with the outcome and the cards I'd been dealt. But, you know, I don't know who told me it, but I was like, it's all about controlling the controllables in life, and I certainly couldn't control the fact that I had another torn ACL, but I guess I could control my response to that.
You know, it's such a great answer, and it's such a great response, and so candid. And the fact of the matter is, you did come back from that, and you're killing it yet again. And then you go to that point that you just made about only being able to control the controllables. I mean, there's a lot of people. It's a great mindset, but there's a lot of people a lot older than you who never actually come to the realization. How did you come to it at such an early age to only focus on those things that you can control?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, maybe I listened to the critics too much early on in my career, and I realized that, you know, wasting my energy thinking about that or thinking about a certain, you know, the way things were going for me in life, whether it was the injuries or, you know, my struggles with grinding through, you know, my degree here at Notre Dame, whatever it might have been, it really, there was no point in wasting energy, like, being anxious about those things or thinking about those things, like just attack what you can. And, you know, I think I flipped the switch probably heading into my true senior year here. And certainly have been perfecting that sense, but it's an everyday battle. It really is, Jim.
Drew Tranquil joining us for a few more moments. He's getting ready for the NFL draft. Drew, you mentioned the Navy SEALs. I had a very good friend by the name of Richard Makowitz, and he's passed away. He had a battle with cancer, but he was probably the toughest guy. Yeah, the toughest guy I've ever known. And I used to train with him, and we train like in martial arts, and we do some work. But he told me early on, Drew, and I know you understand this, because he told it to me, and mentally I got it, but physically I couldn't. He used to push me to take cold showers. And I say, Mac, it's the worst thing in the world. Why would I do that? And I'll never forget his response. He said, because it cuts a toughness groove in your brain. I know you're a big fan of cold showers. How did you first get into them? What do you like about them?
Well, I started, honestly, I was just chopping it up with one of my mentors, and we were talking about Wim Hof, like the Iceman, and kind of his philosophy to life and stuff. And, you know, certainly for me, there was a mental toughness component to me, but more for me, it's like, if you can take a cold shower in the morning, like, and you can like breathe through that and handle that stress, I don't know, you just prime your body to handle any stress that might come your way, for the remainder of the day. And so, that's kind of my approach to it. And it's certainly something I still do. I've been doing probably for the past two and a half, 3 years.
Drew Tranquil joining us. I like it. Let me ask you this. You are a two-time captain in Notre Dame. Then you go to the Senior Bowl. You're a captain there as well. What's your approach when it comes to leadership?
You know, I was a lead by example guy growing up, but I've come to learn that people don't really care what you have to say unless they first know that you care. And so, I don't know, just sitting down, trying to learn where someone's from, what drives them, what makes them tick. People tend to respond better to people when they know that they care about them and those people understand, you know, where you're coming from and you understand where they're coming from.
So finally, you've got the draft coming up in a few weeks. I know you've got something, though, even bigger and more exciting arriving right after that. You and your wife, Jackie, are expecting a baby in May. How exciting is that for you and Jackie? How do you feel about that?
Man, I'm pumped. It was definitely a surprise, you know, a month or two into our marriage and bang, we get the big news. But we're super excited to welcome our son into the world. It's one of the biggest honors beside, you know, marrying her, that you could possibly experience in life. So I've been hearing from a lot of different people that, you know, it's crazy when your child first comes out, you'll never understand what that feels like until it actually happens. So I guess we'll see here in the next 5 or 6 weeks, but it's certainly something I'm really looking forward to.
It certainly is amazing. The 2019 NFL Draft is coming up April 25th through the 27th in Nashville. He's a two-time captain, National Football Foundation National Scholar Athlete, a Werfel Trophy recipient, academic All-American et al. Drew Tranquil, my guest. Drew, so good to have you on the show finally. I really appreciate you. Good luck with all of that, and it was a great conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, Jim, thanks so much for having me on.
Now, before Magic Johnson dumped gasoline on the fire that is the LA Lakers season, last night was supposed to be about Dirk and Dwayne. Dirk playing in his final game in Dallas. Dwanye playing in his final game in Miami. Now, in case you didn't know, Dwayne Wade is retiring at the end of the season. If you didn't know that, welcome back to Earth. Because Dwanye has done an amazing job of reminding everybody that Dwanye is retiring. He even came up with Wade World Tour t-shirts that were sold throughout the season. He had a hashtag on Twitter. So, when the tour finally arrived in Miami last night for the final time, you knew it was going to be a big moment. And it was. There were tributes before the game. There was the already memeable image of him falling into Chrissy Teigen and John Legend. Teigen Teigen, she says, it doesn't matter at this point. The image of him falling into them. Heat fans breaking out with their own tribute during the game.
Highsmith misses. Four minutes left.
Oh, my.
That is what you think that was. That was a Paul Pierce sucks chant. Gotta say, pretty glorious, actually. Nothing like taunting a player who retired years ago for comments that he made a few days ago. It was all great. It really was. It was such a fun time. What a great career. What a great guy. It was all tremendous. But then when the game was over, and Dwanye had played his final game in Miami, the crowd did not want to leave. The crowd did not want to let him go. The crowd still wanted more. They were not ready to say goodbye, and neither was Wade. So he addressed the crowd one last time. But you know that as much as people wanted to hear from him, they wanted him to do that signature move one more time. The scorer's table jump. The scorer's table jump. That's the move that he made famous in the city where he made it famous. That's Dwanye's skyhook. That's his Dirk fadeaway. And as you know, as much planning as there was for this final season, as orchestrated as the entire thing was, you know that Wade had been thinking about and dreaming about that scorer's table jump for a long, long, long time. You know it. So, in front of his adoring Heat fans, in a place that he calls Wade County, let us see that table jump one more time. Before I roll it, if you're near a TV, turn it on, because this is it. The table jump that he had been building towards for the entire season. The table jump that he had been building towards for his entire career. The table jump that he had been building towards his entire life. The table jump to end all table jumps. And one more bit of advice. Get the Kleenex ready, because it is about to get dusty up in here as he does it one last time. Dude is going to nail this jump, and it's going to be the most glorious ish ever. Ready? Roll it.
I only can do it the only way I know how, y'all. That was tragic. Let's try it again. Let's do it this way. All right. As simple as this. Wade County.
Oh!
I love you.
My man jumped up on the table, appeared to lose his balance, tried to jump back up a second time, and just slammed into it. Run this back again, because this is incredible.
I only can do it the only way I know how, y'all. That was tragic. Let's try it again. Let's do it this way. All right. As simple as this. Wade County, I love you.
For as much time and prep that went into his entire year-long tour in that final game, you know there had to be so much more time and prep and thought that went into that jump. And that's how it went? With a bad first jump and an even worse second jump where he face planted on the table that he was trying to jump onto. That table jump was half Carl Lewis, half UFC announcer. After watching that, I'm not sure whether I should go with the uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
And I'll make up for it now.
Excuse me, my bad.
But at least he gave us a new drop. That was tragic.
That was tragic.
That was tragic.
That was tragic.
And then he tried for it a third time. Except at that point, he didn't even try. He just stepped up onto the scorer's table in the most anticlimactic old man moment ever. If you thought that Wade going for 30 last night meant that he still had something in the tank, him tripping on that table jump showed that it is over. Willie Mays, stumbling around in center field, cannot believe Wade's attempted table jump. Grandpa Joe showed greater vert when Charlie broke out that golden ticket than Wade did with that table jump. Yeah, I understand. Your legs are tired after a long game, a long season, a long career. But when did the flash turn into the oaf? The way of Wade is just a smash into a scorer's table. My man, mix in a box jump or two before you try that. Or get a set of stairs. Or ask LeBron for a leg up. Because after all the planning and all the preparation for the ultimate farewell tour, that's not how you want it to end. You don't want one last dance to be one last busted shin on a scorer's table. To quote the man himself, that was tragic. And now, whenever I think of Duane, I wonder what I'm going to think of. Good guy, good career, rings, that he can't spell his own first name. Or that ill-fated, butchered attempt at a signature move. The time he needed a ladder to get up on the scorer's table. My man, I don't want to remember you that way. Except I'm afraid that I'm going to. You leave me no choice.
I only can do it the only way I know how, y'all. That was tragic. Let's try it again.
I mean, it's one thing to miss on the first try, but then to totally face plant. I'm surprised he didn't leave chiclets in that table. That second try was horrible.
That was tragic.
Tom Verducci is going to join Bob Costas and John Smoltz to call tonight's Yankees at Astros game on MLB Network, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Remember, you can read Tom's work on SI.com. Tom, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I am great, Jan. How are you?
Super. Great to talk to you. All right, so you're calling that game tonight, New York and Houston. The Yankees, Tom, have dropped two straight in Houston, and they learned that Luis Severino is going to be out for at least six more weeks with that lat strain. So let me start right there. How big of a blow is that for the Yanks?
Well, that's a really big blow because now you're looking probably shutting him down for 6 weeks. He's going to need another 5 weeks to get cranked up, essentially a second spring training. So really you're looking at all-star break or beyond if you're going to see Severino back on the mound, and that's a best-case scenario. That's a big blow because as much as the Yankees love their bullpen, he is one of those guys who they figured they could get 190 to 200 innings from. They no longer have anybody like that in the rotation, so it becomes more of a patchwork rotation. So there's kind of a cascading effect on the bullpen. But meanwhile, Jim, the bullpen has lost four games already, and they've lost leads in the seventh inning or later the last two nights against Houston. That was supposed to be the backbone of the team.
Tom Verducci joining us. In fact, to that point, Tom, is that just a bad start to the season for that bullpen, or is that a sign of something worse?
Yeah, I think it's a bad start, but I will tell you this, Jim, that with as many strikeout arms as they have in their bullpen, and they probably have more than any team in baseball, they are sometimes going to lose the strike zone and beat themselves. You saw it happen with Britton. You saw it happen with Ottavino. Betances is on the DL. It happens from him to time to time. Chapman, even at sometimes. Those guys lose the strike zone. They don't defend the running game. They can get beat without giving up a lot of hits between walks, wild pitches, stolen bases. So from time to time, that's going to happen to the Yankee bullpen. But over 162, this still should be one of the best bullpens in the league.
We are talking to Tom Verducci. All right, Tom, what about Houston? They start the season 2-5, but they have ripped off five straight, including three come-from-behind wins. How does Houston look to you right now?
I really, really like this team, Jim. I mean, they're just starting to hit their stride right now. We'll see. Bregman left game last night with a hamstring injury. It doesn't look too serious, maybe just missed one game. But they've got a great vibe on that team. And I know people looked at that stat, and they said, well, you know, Keuchel's not there anymore. Lance McCullers out with Tommy John surgery. Did they have enough starting pitching? Colin McHugh has stepped in and just been lights out. He's going tonight against the Yankees. And they have a kid in the minor leagues, I think, is one of the best prospects coming up. You're going to see Forrest Whitley. Reminds me of Walker Buehler a little bit, that he can make an impact straight out of the gate as a rookie. So I think Houston's really well positioned. I think they're the best team in the American League.
Tom Verducci joining us, trying to cover as much ground as I can with you, Tom. You were in Washington last week, for instance, for Bryce Harper's return as well. What did you make of the scene that greeted him and how he responded in that first game with three hits, including that monster bomb and the bat flip?
I'll be honest with you, Jim. It surprised me. I mean, this guy gave 7 years to the Nationals. They made him a contract offer that was about $100 million less in net present value than what he signed for. It really was a non-competitive offer. He didn't leave on any bad terms, and yet it was an overwhelmingly negative reaction when he walked back in the ballpark. I thought the classy thing to do was to give him one ovation, you know, thanks for those years, and then after that he's a Philly, and you can go ahead and boo him and get on him as you would a visiting player, but no recognition for what he gave that franchise. I was really disappointed in it. It didn't surprise me that Bryce stepped up, responded with three hits, the home run, two extra base hits, three RBIs. He's a red light kind of guy, Jim. When that camera light goes on, he responds. He's done it his whole life. I mean, think about it. This kid's been playing as the guy on the field from the time he was probably 10 years old, right? You know, he never had the luxury of just not being accountable, of hiding in the shadows of somebody else. Pressure, spotlight, always on him. I got to be honest with you, Jim. I've known him since he was 16 years old. I see a different Bryce Harper right now. I think he's much more relaxed. He's having more fun than I've ever seen him have on a baseball field. Listen, he's off to a crazy start here the first couple of weeks. It's not going to hold up for 162. But I can just tell, just mentally, body image on the field, the way he's moving, I haven't seen Bryce like this, and these should be his best years. It's starting to look like it.
Tom Verducci is joining us. Now, Tom, you've also got a piece up on SI.com about the managers of the Nationals and the Phillies, Dave Martinez and Gabe Kapler. And then also you get into, of course, the use of analytics in Major League Baseball. Like, when you look at the impact of the analytic departments, how much of the game right now, Tom, is played on paper? In other words, what percentage of the decisions that are made by managers today are all about the numbers?
A lot of them, but they have more numbers to deal with. I mean, listen, there are some cases where management will suggest lineup changes to managers, matchups. Everybody knows what matchups they want going into a game. And it used to be you did it by gut feel. You know, I like this guy in a certain spot, pinch hitting or pitching the eighth inning. Now, the way they match up, it's interesting. The way they match up these matchups late in the game, which is what the game is from the sixth inning on, they're matching up your stuff on the mound, the way you pitch, the plane of your pitch against the plane of somebody else's swing. It's no longer just, you know, right versus right or left versus left or very simple, you know, he's two hits out of six at bats. People throw those away now. It's much more scientific. Managers have all that information. But in talking to those two guys specifically, rookie managers who I thought were very conventional when it came to running games by the book and by the numbers, they realized there still has to be a place in this game for reacting to what you see out there. And I think both managers are a little more balanced this year in that regard, and I think you have to be. Yeah, the numbers tell you a lot. I think it's crazy to just not look at them. But there are some points in the game where you have to say, I know what the numbers say, but what I'm looking at now is going to change my mind.
Tom Verducci joins me for another moment or so. Tom, I'm curious, what about the players? Not just in Philadelphia, but the players around Major League Baseball. What do they make of the way that managers approach the game now?
Well, it's interesting. Last year at the Phillies, I thought Gabe turned off some of his players by trying to get every little incremental edge that he could get. For instance, last year he had Scott Kingery in the starting lineup in the second inning. Second inning, when his spot came around, he pinch hit for him. The dude never even got an AB in the game.
Huh.
Professional baseball players don't like that. And I'm sure he had a very good analytical reason to do that. But players don't like it. I see that as a sign of disrespect when you're looking at the numbers to that degree. But I will tell you this, Jim, there's a generational divide. I think the young players coming up are very comfortable with analytics. They understand the numbers. They want them themselves. Older players, maybe not so much. So I think the younger players now are more in groove and more in sync with what managers are doing in terms of analytics.
All right, Tom, I noticed that you're going to give the commencement address to the College of Communications at Penn State next month, which is an incredible honor unto itself. What's it mean to you to be going back to your alma mater, and do you know what you're planning to talk to them about specifically?
Well, it's huge. You know, it's a great honor. There's no question about it. I had a great time at Penn State. My oldest son went to Penn State, so I'll be speaking from the heart in regards to my connection to the school. But I got a note from the school, Jim, that told me this speech has to be between 8 to 10 minutes. I was preparing for this magnus opus, right? I guess that's the young generation, the analytical generation. The attention span's a lot shorter. So the hardest thing to do is to write concisely, quickly, short, and still be, you know, punchy and interesting. So I got my work cut out for me in terms of getting 8 to 10 minutes to try to keep these kids awake.
Kathleen, you're on. So instead of you saying what I did or didn't do, why don't you give me your pick, Kathleen?
Penguins! Penguins all the way! They gotta step it up and take back what was taken from them last year, which should have been a three-peat if old dumb old Washington hadn't got in their way. Penguins all the way!
All right, so Kathleen, let me ask you this. What do you...
Four-time Stanley Cup winners for Sydney and the rest of them...
Good night now!